From Arizona to Minnesota, Missouri to Florida, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the partial government shutdown is over, at least temporarily. Jason Pye of FreedomWorks is here to explain why shutdowns are occurring and what some senators are trying to do to prevent future closures. Former Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz roiled the political world this past week when he said he might mount an independent campaign for the presidency. Andy Roth has the real story. Corporate welfare brought Foxconn to Wisconsin, but is that sound policy? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Michael Farron from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. And the Democrat socialist agenda is getting a lot of attention and therefore needs to be taken seriously. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, explains why on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The longest partial government shutdown ever has come to at least a temporary end, but it could resume later this month. Jason Pye is Vice President of Legislative Affairs at FreedomWorks. He is here to explain how we got into this mess and what steps might be taken to prevent future government shutdowns. Jason, welcome to American Radio Journal. Jason, before we talk about what is wrong with Congress, and of course that could be a lengthy conversation, and some proposals to help prevent future government shutdowns, when we look at the congressional budgeting process, how should it work? How did it used to work before we got in this cycle of dysfunction?
By law, it's Section 300 of the Congressional Budget Act of 1974. Congress is supposed to begin work on appropriations bills on May 15th. That means that's the date they can begin passing appropriations bills for the coming fiscal year. Now, the fiscal year operates from October 1st through September 30th. We are currently in fiscal year 2019, which ends on September 30th of this year. But these appropriations bills, there are 12 of them, and they appropriate funds for each department or agency or program in the federal government. So what's happening right now is that Congress passed five appropriations bills. It was defense, the legislative branch, military construction and veterans affairs, and I think energy and water, and the health and human services appropriations bill. There were seven they didn't pass. Now, those five they did pass, they account for about 75% of all discretionary spending. And discretionary spending in budget terms is about 30% of all federal spending. There's the remaining 70% is either mandatory spending, which includes entitlements like Social Security and Medicare, and interest on the national debt. So those things, those two aspects of federal spending are not appropriated. They're on autopilot. They're what we call baked in the cake. But everything else is appropriated by Congress through the appropriations process. So if you get to September 30th and a spending bill has not been completed, Congress has options. It can pass a continuing resolution, which just basically carries forward the spending from the previous fiscal year into the next fiscal year until a specified date. They can go, usually they go by a monthly or 3 month basis. Sometimes it's a few weeks if they think they're close to a deal and they can go forward. Or they can carry it to the end of the next fiscal year. In this case, what happened was we got to September 30th. Those seven appropriations bills had not been completed. And Congress passed a continuing resolution. And then finally, they got to December 21st, I think, which was another deadline day to pass those appropriations bills or pass a CR. And they didn't do it because of a dispute over border wall funding. And the government shut down. There have been many shutdowns or several shutdowns over the course of what I call the modern budget era, which began in really 1974. This 35-day shutdown, the longest in history, the prior longest in history was the shutdown that occurred between December of 1995 and January of 1996. And the difference between the two is, again, in the one in 95 and 96 was a partial shutdown like this one, but it was a dispute that actually led to something good. There was a 21-day shutdown. Several hundred thousand employees weren't getting, government employees weren't getting paid. And that includes those who were deemed essential and had to show up to work anyway. But the issue at stake was spending levels, how they were going to determine spending levels, projected rates of growth. And that shutdown led to 4 years, four consecutive years of balanced budgets. that ended after fiscal year 2000 or 2001. This one's a little different because it was a policy disagreement over one issue that affected only one of the appropriations bills, and that was the Department of Homeland Security's appropriations bill. Although they're negotiating, the conference committee negotiating the Homeland Security appropriations bill met yesterday, and it was jovial from what I understand. They were not lobbing insults at each other, but they didn't seem to be anywhere near an agreement yet. And here we are. There's 15 days until the government shuts down again because we're operating on a CR that put us through February 15th. And if they don't get it done, if they don't get something done by then, the government will shut down again.
So we may, in fact, just be in the eye of the hurricane here. We'll see where this goes. But some members of Congress, Jason, are looking at legislation that would prevent this from occurring in the future. And I'm talking about Senators Rand Paul and Rob Portman. There's this proposed Government Shutdown Prevention Act. Tell us what the senators are proposing.
So there are actually two bills. It's Senator Paul has introduced the Government Shutdown Prevention Act, which in the event that an appropriations bill is not completed by the September 30th deadline, it's either one bill, one appropriations bill, one of the 12 that hasn't been completed, or several of them, depending on how many haven't been done, an automatic continuing resolution would be passed. And it would cut immediately 1% of federal spending affected by those appropriations bills. So it only covers the 1% in the appropriations bills that haven't been passed. And then it would cut an additional 1% every 90 days that an appropriations bill has not been completed. Senator Portman's bill, it's called the End Government Shutdowns Act, it basically has the same function, except for it's a little bit different. It does not require an immediate spending cut for the affected appropriations bills. It would cut 1% after 120 days and then cut an additional 1% every 90 days thereafter, very similar to Senator Paul's bill. So those are the two proposals that are sort of on the table. The one that's really picking up steam and the one we're noticing more and more Republicans, especially, and no Democrats are on the bill, is Senator Portman's. As of this morning, it has 26 Republican co-sponsors, including a couple that caught me by surprise, like Senator Lisa Murkowski, who's certainly no conservative. She's on board with it. So we prefer the Paul bill, but the Portman bill is the one that seems to be getting the traction.
I suppose there's no talk about returning to the regular order of business and having Congress actually do its job in a timely manner.
There's a lot of talk about it, but there's no real effort, it seems, to do that. I mean, look, conservatives in both the House and Senate, especially when even we heard this a lot in 114th Congress and the most recent Congress, the 115th Congress, they talked about the need to return to regular order to get to ensure that the process for passing appropriations bills was happening regularly. And part of this, especially on the House side, there was frustration because they were being asked to, especially under then Speaker John Boehner and then after him, Speaker Ryan, to pass large omnibus bills. These are bills that take in appropriations bills that haven't been passed or all appropriations bills, which has been the case, and pass these large omnibus bills that there was no formal negotiation over.
We have been talking with Jason Pye, who is the Vice President of Legislative Affairs at FreedomWorks. Jason, tell us a little bit about FreedomWorks and where folks can go to read more.
FreedomWorks is a grassroots organization. We have about 5 or 6 million activists across the country. And we train them on issues related to limited government. We mobilize them on these issues. So you can find more about FreedomWorks at freedomworks.org.
Jason Pye of FreedomWorks. Jason, thank you for being here.
Hey, Loman. Thank you for having me. Take care.
We are joined today by Andy Roth, who is not really with the Club for Growth anymore. Scott Parkinson, as we talked about last week, is taking over the time slot from Andy, but Andy will from time to time join us. So, Andy, it is, of course, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
And best of luck to you and your new venture, and we will look forward to occasionally having you share your insight with us, as you have for many, many years. And one of the projects that you've worked on, you can explain to our audience to refresh them. 4 years ago when we began the presidential cycle, and I regret to inform everyone that we are starting another one, the Club for Growth put out white papers, background information on the many Republicans who were seeking the Republican presidential nomination. For 2020, it's the shoe on the other foot. They're going to be a cavalcade of Democrats and perhaps even an independent. So tell us a bit about the white paper project and who is the first person that you're looking at.
The Club for Growth is going to start issuing some white papers, I believe, and there are some interesting characters on the Democratic side, including Senator Kamala Harris, Senator Elizabeth Warren, former Congressman Beto O'Rourke. But the one that's intriguing us right now, and frankly intriguing a lot of people, is Howard Schultz, the CEO of Starbucks. He is toying with the idea of running as an independent because he sees the grave threat that the far left is providing, and he wants to tap into some of the energy on the right that don't care for Trump. So he's going to make a decision, I think, not until the summer, but I think it's going to be interesting how he approaches this if he decides to get in. And I think his policies are going to come front and center pretty quick.
Let's talk a little bit about the policies that Howard Schultz has discussed so far. He, of course, as you mentioned, was the CEO of Starbucks. So he does come at this from a business perspective. And some of the positions that he staked out so far, Andy, are not really traditional Democrat positions, are they?
Correct. I mean, he does have some lefty positions on climate change, on gun control, and on immigration. He's fairly open borders, but or pro-amnesty. But he thinks that the gravest threat to the country right now is the $22 trillion in national debt. And he wants to fix the budget process and hopefully get back to a balanced budget. This is something that no Democrat ever talks about. Barack Obama certainly didn't. Because of that, I think that Howard Schultz is going to basically run on sort of a Bill Clinton Democrat ticket, where he's moderate enough to denounce some of the views that the Democrats are talking about, like getting rid of private health insurance or having a 70% marginal tax rate for billionaires. So I think he's going to approach this very much like a technocrat, I think. I don't think he has any ideology about low tax rates. I just think he wants to view the government as a business and he wants to balance the books. That's a little scary, because it could mean tax increases as part of a balanced budget. But it's definitely more appealing than what the far left is talking about. Likewise, he doesn't support Trump's tariff policies, so he would definitely be more free trade. So all of this kind of makes for an interesting candidacy if he decides to run. There are a lot of moderate Republicans who could probably swallow some of the things that he's talking about, because they dislike Trump enough, and they certainly don't have an appetite for Elizabeth Warren or Kamala Harris.
Well, of course, the Democrats are in a rush to get as far to the left as they can, and that's sort of what a candidate needs to do in the Democrat Party in order to win a primary, but it doesn't play well in a general election, especially with independent voters. So you have Howard Schultz here staking out a more moderate stance on most issues, Andy. As a independent, who is he going to draw from? Is he going to draw from moderate Democrats who just can't stomach the ultra-left? Is he going to pull votes from Donald Trump because there are some Republicans who are offended by his personality and approach? Who does he hurt more?
Trump tweeted out that Schultz didn't have the guts to run, and that was Trump's way of trying to egg him on, because he thinks that if Schultz does run, he'll pull more Democrat votes, enabling Trump to win re-election. And you're hearing that same sort of belief from the Democrats. Michael Bloomberg, who's thinking about running himself, is telling Schultz not to run as an independent. And a lot of the hierarchy in the Democrat Party is urging him not to run. It's getting almost nasty, and frankly, to see these two camps fighting each other. So I think people very much believe that Schultz would draw more from the Democrats. One interesting thing is that this is a two-party system in this country, and that's unfortunate. I truly believe there should be an avenue for more candidates trying to win elections. And so as an independent, getting access to the ballot typically just means getting signatures in a lot of states, which should be easy to do given Schultz's wealth. He's worth about $3 or $4 billion. Plus, in order to get in the debates are controlled by the two parties, not by some third independent commission. It's literally controlled by the two parties. But the two parties have agreed that if a third party candidate is at least 15% in the polls, then they are invited to the debates. And right now, Schultz's team has indicated that over the next few months, as he's going around on a book tour, he's going to do polling, and I think the 15% is going to be the floor from which he will make his decision because of that debate policy. So he's definitely not going to run if he doesn't see a viable path to victory. But if he does see at least 15%, then I think he's going to give this a lot of serious thought.
Andy Roth again with us. He is departing from the Club for Growth, but still will be back with us from time to time as important issues arise. But Andy, since you did this for many years, tell us once again about the Club for Growth and where folks can go to find out more.
Sure thing. Well, first off, thank you, Loman, for hosting me for all these years. I know it's been quite a long ride, and it is sad that I'm no longer going to be able to do it every week, but I will look forward to doing it from time to time. But yes, the Club for Growth is a membership organization out of D.C., but we have over 250,000 members from all across the country, from all walks of life, and we're united because we believe in economic freedom. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org, and if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Once again, Andy Roth. Andy, as always, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
State governments often offer a wide range of economic incentives to get companies to expand or locate within their borders. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Michael Farron from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University about the impact of such corporate welfare. Eric?
We see this over and over again. We see state governments throwing huge amounts of money at corporations, at businesses, trying to get them to locate in a certain place to bring jobs to the state, supposedly. And then we see over and over again that these economic development schemes don't really work out. And maybe the best example in recent history has just occurred this week in Wisconsin, where Foxconn, the Taiwanese-based company that was offered more than $3 billion in subsidies to locate a new manufacturing plant in suburban Milwaukee, now Foxconn says, well, maybe we're not going to build that factory after all. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Michael Farron. He is a research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, and he's a friend of the show. Michael has written extensively about the Foxconn deal in Wisconsin, including a research paper that was published last year and an op-ed published earlier this month. So we're glad to have him here to break down the latest developments. Michael, thanks for joining us, and I hope you're staying warm today.
Trying to with the 12 degree temperatures in Washington right now.
Yeah, it is very, very cold out there right now. I like it cold, but this is a little much for me. The big chill in Wisconsin, though, it's not just the weather, although it's certainly that too, but it's the news that these thousands of jobs, 13,000 jobs supposedly, that Foxconn was going to bring to this manufacturing plant, well, that might not be happening now. What's the latest here?
So the latest is that the assistant to the Foxconn CEO essentially said that factory that we promised, there's not going to be a factory. It's not economically feasible to build TVs or liquid crystal displays in the U.S. The labor costs are just too high, and it's going to be something else instead. It's going to be a knowledge campus for research. And everyone kind of said, what?
Yeah, because this was supposed to be a manufacturing facility. It was going to be blue-collar jobs. President Trump was out there with former Governor Scott Walker for a groundbreaking ceremony last year in, I think it was May or June. They talked about how this plant was proof that manufacturing was coming back to America. Now, here we are a year later, and hold on, looks like it's actually going to be a lot of white-collar jobs instead of blue-collar ones. Look, that's not necessarily bad, but it's not what Foxconn was promising. They've fallen behind already on some of their hiring promises. And the real tragedy here, as you've written about, Michael, is the fact that some people have literally lost their homes and their property over this factory. They've used eminent domain there in Wisconsin to clear space for this factory, and now it might not get built at all.
Absolutely. So the initial Foxconn plant area covers about 1,200 acres. That's about 2 square miles. And the city of Mount Pleasant, or village of Mount Pleasant, was actually under contract to acquire a total of 2,900 acres, almost 4.5 square miles for Foxconn. And it has been buying up that property and moving people off of it, bulldozing farms, And some local residents have stopped and tried to fight it. There's an older retired couple that says, we've lived here 40 years and we don't intend to move. There's a family pumpkin farm that's fighting it. And there's actually a retired couple as well that just built their retirement home there and doesn't want to move. So in that sense, it's actually reminiscent of the Kelo versus New London case, where Suzette Kelo was forced off of her retirement home that she had restored with her own hands when Pfizer wanted the redevelopment firm wanted the property for a Pfizer expansion.
Yeah, of course. I think that's a good comparison. And of course, the plant there never got built either. Suzette Kelo and other people had their homes torn down. And now there's nothing there at all, just a bunch of empty space. And I think that's the most infuriating part about all of this is when you see people who are literally losing their property, losing their homes. That makes me mad. But it's also pretty infuriating and frustrating to see states like Wisconsin throw billions of dollars after Foxconn and to lure them to this location, to lure them to the United States and to get them to build in Wisconsin. And now Foxconn is already less than a year later backing away from those promises. I mean, this is a lot of money on the table.
That's right. So Wisconsin is on the hook for $1.5 billion to Foxconn. It, just in terms of job creation, they're on the hook for $1.35 billion for capital expenditures, tax credits for capital expenditures, as well as another $130 million for sales tax exemptions for construction, and $250 million into infrastructure investments, and another $140 million for upgrading the electrical infrastructure, all of which, who knows, is actually going to be necessary because Foxconn may not actually build the plant that it promised in the first place.
We are talking with Michael Farron from the Mercatus Center. We're talking about the folly of these economic development schemes like the one that was offered to Foxconn in Wisconsin. Only about a minute left here, Michael. Let's play a little bit of a hypothetical game, though. Let's say, theoretically, that Foxconn had delivered on all the promises that it had made to the state of Wisconsin. Even then, would these subsidies have been worth it?
Absolutely not. The broad-based academic research on economic development subsidies is that they don't actually work. And what that means is that they don't actually sway a firm's decision to locate in one place versus another place. The decision that a firm makes is based on deeper profitability underlying measures, and that's exactly the reason why Foxconn has decided to not locate its manufacturing operations in Wisconsin, because they say it's just not profitable.
Yeah, I think a really good lesson out of the state of Wisconsin, a lesson that will probably be ignored by other states in the future, but a lesson that should be paid attention to about what happens when you have these big economic development giveaways that rarely ever pan out. That is unfortunately all the time we have for today. Michael Farron from the Mercatus Center, thanks for taking some time and being here.
Thanks, Eric.
And again, that is Michael Farron from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. You can check out his work on the Foxconn deal and on eminent domain and other issues at Mercatus.org. You can check out our coverage of economic development schemes gone wrong, including stories about some big stadium subsidies. It's Super Bowl week. Check those out at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I am Eric Boehm, and you can catch us right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The threat posed by the Democrat-Socialist agenda is real and could have a devastating effect on the U.S. economy. So says Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Newly elected Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez suggested a tax rate of perhaps 70% to fund her Green New Deal. The congressperson acknowledged that it was an ambitious goal and would require a great deal of change rapidly. There are Democrat socialists who believe that income redistribution is the panacea for the world and the solution to most of our problems. Such perspectives are gaining ground in the United States, and we would be naive to not acknowledge it. I would encourage all of us to take this debate seriously and to not engage in smear tactics ridiculing the person making the statement. Argumentum ad hominems distract from the core issue. For instance, attacking Congressperson Ocasio-Cortez on her college dance video to attempt to discredit her is counterproductive. Attack the idea, not the person. We may find that there are more people in this country who believe that such tax rates and taxing the wealthy make sense. Even Bernie Sanders, a recent presidential contender, advocated for higher taxes on the wealthy, and he did fairly well. His plans included higher tax rates, closing loopholes, and changing the estate tax laws. The economic implications to a society of such tax rates are catastrophic. This debate centers on the very foundation and fabric of our society and the consequences of losing this battle, which are profound. Concurrently, there's been a great deal of discussion about wealth inequality in the United States. The fallacy of attempting to solve a wealth inequity problem through income redistribution of higher tax rates is due to the sheer complexity of the tax code, which makes the discussion for the average person mind-numbing at best. Confusing income with wealth is one of the cornerstones of the illogic of the Democrat socialist movement. It's just inaccurate because of the complexity of the tax code in the United States. All of us must understand that no political body or government passed the laws of supply and demand. Natural laws supersede any political initiative, and attempts to interfere with the free movement of capital and goods is always disastrous. In the 1960s, when the tax rates at that time were much higher, Democrat socialists today compare those tax rates then with what they are proposing today. Democrat socialists do not seem to recall what was happening in the early 1960s. President Kennedy reduced the tax rates with Congress because of the stifling effect those tax rates were having in the nation. The president was trying to get the nation moving again, and he succeeded. In the 1970s, there was a massive inflation during the Carter administration. The Council on Wage and Price Stability, called CALPS, was created to curb inflation. Drastic efforts were perceived to be needed to be done in this economic attempt, and interfering with the market was undertaken. Shortly after this effort, the economy entered into a fairly major recession. Other efforts, such as changing minimum wage, guaranteed incomes, unrestrained growth of social programs, without looking at the economic implications of those proposals, is foolhardy. When I first saw the increase in tax proposals from Bernie Sanders, I was somewhat surprised by the number of extremely wealthy people who seemed to be supporting the effort. Initially, I found it strange that extremely wealthy people seemed to favor tax policies encouraging wealth redistribution. It seemed illogical that the super rich would favor wealth redistribution since it would adversely affect them. But then natural laws and the perspective of self-interest comes to play almost immediately. In reality, taxing income has little effect on the wealthy, since income would be taxed and not wealth. Self-interest of the wealthy reinforces the fallacy of attempting to interfere with markets other than creating a rule of law for which people and organizations can operate. The difficulty with all of this analysis is that it's complicated. It's easier to explain to people that it is income that is creating the problem of inequity versus wealth. As a result of this difficulty, the super wealthy are extraordinarily willing to jump on the income redistribution bandwagon and to use Democrat socialists to do it because, quite candidly, it doesn't affect them. The Democrat socialist agenda must be taken very seriously because of the consequences of ignoring it are fatal. Efforts to interfere with markets always cause people to find their self-interest to survive. It is natural that people do that. Efforts to increase tax rates without considering the consequences of doing it may have the exact opposite effect as to what people expect. In my time in the Marine Corps, I have seen nations collapse in Eastern Europe and in the Caribbean, as well as in the Middle East. Interfere with an economic market at your own peril. Take the Democrat socialist agenda seriously and defend our system of commerce and our way of life. If we fail at this battle, the consequences will be felt for decades to come. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country. They include our newest affiliate, WWFA-FM in Florence, Alabama. Welcome to our new listeners in the Yellowhammer State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.